Okay, I'm going to outline our computation of the three-point functions of chiral operators and d equal to 4 and equal to 4 Super-Yangmuir's theory at large n. This work is contained in this preprint and was done in collaboration with Songmin Lee, Mukund Rangamani and Nathan Seiberg. This is the outline of my talk. I will first review the organization of operators in the Super-Yangmuir's theory under the d equal to 4 n equal to 4 superconformal algebra. I will then outline our computation of the relevant correlation functions at weak coupling, then outline the computation of the same correlation functions at strong coupling using the ADS-CFT correspondence, and finally end with a discussion of our results. It is perhaps appropriate to summarize my results before getting into the details of the talk. So we performed the calculation of correlation functions of three-point functions of chiral operators, chiral primary operators, at infinite n, but at very small and very large lambda, and obtained the same results at each of these two points. This and some other pieces of evidence led us to conjecture that these three-point functions are not renormalized as a function of lambda. That is, are given by the same same formula for every lambda at large n. We even speculated that the free result for the three-point functions of these operators is correct even at finite n, so for all lambda and n. Okay. So I will try to tell you why we made these speculations in this talk. Okay, so we wanted to calculate some correlation functions of Super-Yangmuir's theory, some three-point functions of Super-Yangmuir's theory, using the ADS-CFT correspondence. And the first natural question to ask is, which correlation functions should one calculate? So we used group theory as a guide to the interesting correlation functions to calculate. And that is what I want to motivate now. So if you look at the operators in Super-Yangmuir's theory, they are organized into families under the d equal to 4 n equal to 4 superconformal algebra. And these families have the following structure. Any family has an operator of lowest dimension, or actually a multiplet of operators under SO4, the Lorentz group, and SO6R, the R symmetric group, of lowest dimension. These operators I will refer to as primary operators, superconformal primary operators, through the rest of my talk. Every family is infinite dimensional. The other operators in the family, the non-superconformal primary operators in the family, may be obtained from the superconformal primaries by acting on it with the generators of supersymmetry, Q. Okay. These other operators are called descendant operators. Okay. There is another way of viewing this infinite dimensional representation. Any representation of the superconformal algebra may be decomposed into representations of the conformal algebra, which of course is a subalgebra of the superconformal algebra. It turns out that every representation of the superconformal algebra may be decomposed into a finite number of representations of the conformal algebra. That is depicted in this figure here. Every representation of the conformal algebra, in turn, forms an infinite dimensional family of operators. Okay. Of relevance to my talk is the fact that the d equal to 4, n equal to 4 superconformal algebra has a number of special short representations, which I'm going to call chiral through the rest of this talk. These representations are short in the sense that they may be decomposed into a fewer number of conformal representations as compared to the generic representation. This is depicted schematically in this figure. So if a generic representation is decomposed into, say, 5 representations of the conformal algebra, a chiral representation may be decomposed into, say, 3 representations of the same algebra. Okay. Chiral representations are the analog, the conceptual analog of BPS particles. So a generic representation of the super Poincaré algebra may be decomposed into a large number of particles. A BPS representation of the super Poincaré algebra may be decomposed into a small number of particles. Remember, the particle is the representation of the Poincaré algebra, so this is more or less a precise analogy. Okay. For the UN theory that we are going to study, The chiral primaries are scalars under SO4. Transform is the kth traceless symmetric representation under SO6 and have scaling dimension K. The theory probably possesses no other chiral operators. It certainly possesses many other representations under the superconformal algebra, many other operators that are primary but not chiral. I will have nothing to say about these operators in my talk. Okay, so I'm now going to quickly outline the computation of the three-point functions at small lambda and infinite n. So I should first tell you what the chiral primary operators... So I'm going to first tell you what the chiral primary operators in four-dimensional Super-Yangmuir's theory are. Well, recall that four-dimensional Super-Yangmuir's theory has a set of six scalar fields which transform in the vector under SO6. These scalar fields are transformed in the adjoint under UN, and so are UN matrices. So consider taking the product of K of these scalar fields, K of these scalar field matrices, and taking the trace over UN of this product. Consider contracting the free SO6 indices with an SO6 tensor, which I've denoted by CI in this formula, such that this SO6 tensor is totally symmetric, of course. Okay, but totally symmetric, not of course, but totally symmetric, and is also traceless under contraction of any two SO6 indices. Turns out that these operators are the chiral primary operators in the n equal to 4 Super-Yangmuir's theory. Okay, and I'm now going to outline the computation of the three-point functions of these operators in free-field theory. So I normalize my Super-Yangmuir's action such that the FF term comes with a minus 1 over 2 G Yangmuir square. And that implies that the propagator of the scalar fields in my theory is given by this formula. Note there's a G Yangmuir square in the numerator. Two-point functions of these operators may be easily computed in free-field theory merely by contracting all the legs in the operators. So consider operator 1 with, say, 4 legs, operator 2 with 4 legs. Each leg represents a scalar particle. And contraction of these 4 scalar particles, so pairwise between the two operators, is very easy to do and gives you the following result for the two-point functions of these chiral operators. This result has been computed in the large n limits, so we've considered only planar graphs. Okay, the quantity CC contracted refers to, well, the obvious contraction of C1 and C2 with all SO6 indices. It will turn out that at large coupling, we are only able to compute these correlation functions, of normalized operators. And so to facilitate comparison with the large coupling result, I now rescale my chiral operators with some constants, k-dependent constants, such that these rescaled operators have unit two-point functions. I will now proceed to show you the result for the computation of three-point functions of these rescaled operators. So you can compute the three-point functions exactly like you'd compute two-point functions. It's all very simple. And the three-point functions of rescaled operators are given by this formula. In this formula, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3 refer to the number of legs contracted between pairs of operators. So, for instance, alpha 1 is given by this formula in terms of k1, k2, k3, where k1 is the number of legs emanating out of operator 1, k2 out of operator 2, and so on. And alpha 1, sort of in this diagram, represents the number of legs contracted between operator 2 and operator 3. Okay, that's not probably terribly important. But this is the result, and I want to emphasize that this result is correct only at infinite n. It receives non-zero corrections at finite n from non-planar diagrams. Okay, so that was easy. Now I move on to the computation of the same three-point functions at large lambda. Because this computation is seems like a very difficult computation to do in field theory, but we use the recently proposed ADS-C CFT correspondence to carry out the computation. Okay, so I remind you of the correspondence. Correlation functions in Super-Yangmull's four-dimensional Super-Yangmull's theory are related to the partition function of 2B theory on ADS5 cross S5 as a function of boundary values of the fields of string theory on ADS5 cross S5. Okay. I remind you also that 1 by n corrections to the large n limit of Super-Yangmull's theory are related to quantum corrections to the classical limit of string theory, and 1 by lambda corrections to the large lambda limit of Super-Yangmull's theory are related to alpha prime corrections to the supergravity limit of string theory. Since neither quantum corrections nor alpha prime corrections to string theory are pleasant to deal with, we have use this correspondence only to compute three-point functions in the large n and large lambda limit. Okay, so how did we go about it? The procedure is conceptually extremely simple. The first thing you have to do is identify the supergravity fields that couple to the operators in interest, in this case the chiral primary operators of the theory. Now, having done that, compute the supergravity action as a function of arbitrary boundary values of these fields, and then differentiate a little go through a certain song and dance, and you get your answer. Okay, of course, nothing is ever so simple, and there were subtleties in performing the calculation, which I will now sort of review for you. The first problem you run across is that S int, the interaction action between bulk fields at the boundary and boundary degrees of freedom, the interaction action that is used in the prescription to relate S matrix elements in the bulk to correlation functions on the boundary, is not a known function. Okay. So how do you get around this problem? Since S int is not known, there is no straightforward dynamical way of establishing a correspondence between fields and operators. And so to get around this problem, we used symmetry instead. So schematically, this is the procedure. You can look at the linearized equations of supergravity about the ADS5 plus S5 background. This is what Neuwenhuysen and collaborators did more than 10 years ago. And notice that on-shell fluctuations to linear order about this background may be grouped into multiplets under the superconformal algebra. This was noticed by Gunaid and collaborators some time ago. Okay. Now, operators in the in the n equal to 4, d equal to 4 theory are also grouped into representations under the superconformal algebra. If the proposed ADS-CFT correspondence is indeed correct, then these observations are enough to establish a one-to-one mapping between operators and fields. So, operators in the boundary theory and on-shell fluctuations of fields in the bulk. Okay, so that was nice. But this matching seems insufficient for two reasons. The first reason is that the fields corresponding to the operators of interest by this procedure have been identified only to linear order, because Neuwenhuysen's analysis was carried out only to linear order and fluctuations. This, however, turns out not to be a problem, as quadratic corrections or higher order corrections to the linear order identification of fields turns out to correct computed correlation functions only by contact terms. Okay, and since we will concentrate on computing correlation functions at separated points, so forget about contact terms. Okay, this is the analog of the statement of the sort of well-known fact in the bulk that field redefinitions do not change S matrix elements. The second reason that this group theoretic matching between operators and on-shell fluctuation seems insufficient is that from group theory you're only able to identify fluctuation with an operator up to an overall normalization, up to a normalization that depends on which operator you're considering. This indeed is rather serious and will have the following consequence for us. We will only be able to compute correlation functions of normalized operators using our procedure. I want to emphasize that this normalization ambiguity is distinct from another normalization ambiguity I will refer to later on in this talk. This second normalization problem refers to the normalization of the action, the overall normalization of the 2B action. Okay, so that was subtlety one. The second sort of problem that one comes that one has to deal with is that gravity is a gauge theory, and so not every field that you see in the action is a physical field, it's a physical degree of freedom. To deal with physical degrees of freedom, one needs to impose a gauge, and having imposed a gauge, solve Gauss's law to eliminate constrained fields in the description of the theory. Okay. So I'm going to be dividing conceptually fields in 2B string theory into physical fields, gauged fields, and constrained fields. Remember, I wish to sort of emphasize that only physical fields represent true degrees of freedom in the theory. Only physical fields appear in representations of the superconformal algebra. And only physical fields are put into correspondence with the operators of the world volume of N equal to 4, D equal to 4 theory. Okay, so the procedure I outlined for you before should be modified to say one should compute the supergravity action as a function of boundary values only of physical fields, setting the value of all. Okay, and since we are interested in three-point functions of a certain set of operators, we'll compute the supergravity action as a function of the boundary values of the fields that correspond to these operators, set the value of all other physical fields to zero at the boundary. Through the rest of this talk, I will denote the physical fields that correspond to conformal primaries by the symbol S. S is our functions on the ADS. Okay. The third problem one has to deal with is that the 2B supergravity action is complicated. This has two aspects to it. Firstly, there isn't a simple covariant action for 2B supergravity because of the presence of the self-dual five-form field. Secondly, and perhaps a little more seriously, or a little more irritatingly, even the Einstein action, when viewed as a function of physical fields alone, is a rather horrible non-local function of these physical fields. It's not pleasant to work with. So to circumvent this problem, we decided to deal with equations of motion rather than the action. Remember that studying linearized equations of motion was sufficient to determine the fields of interest, was sufficient to determine the functional forms of SI. Studying the quadratic equations of motion in S will be sufficient to calculate the three-point functions that I'm interested in. To do that, what we did was to compute the quadratic equations of motion in S, and then construct from these equations of motion an action that I've called S effective of S, whose variation gives rise to these equations of motion. Of course, in going from equations of motion to an action, you lose normalization information. You can compute this action only up to an overall normalization. And you need to have some argument, an independent argument, to fix this normalization. The argument we used was, we used two separate arguments in our paper. The first one was a comparison with the correctly normalized action given by Sorokin and collaborators. And the second was relating this, the second is not terribly important. Okay, so we went through this procedure, and we got a certain result, and I am going to show you this result now. The effective action that governs the fluctuations of these S fields was computed to be this following action. It contains a quadratic term, a quadratic piece which has kinetic and mass terms. The mass terms are k-dependent. You remember what k is. It's the size of the primary operator, the number of scalar fields in the primary operator. And it has an interaction term, which is of this form, where g is a terribly complicated function of i1, i2, i3. I sort of want to emphasize that at an intermediate stage in the calculation, this g had maybe 100 terms in it. It all simplifies very nicely right at the end, but only right at the end. Okay. Using this effective action and using the results worked out so nicely in such a user-friendly fashion by Friedman and collaborators, you can process this action to give you an answer for the correlation functions of the well volume theory, and the answer is boxed in this formula here. Maybe this formula looks familiar because it's the same formula as you saw 15 minutes ago. It's identical to the result obtained at lambda 0 in the free field limit. Okay. So that's a rather interesting answer. And what are the consequences? Well, since we've computed these correlation functions at infinite n, at small lambda and large lambda, and obtained the same results in both cases, it is natural perhaps to conjecture that the three-point functions are independent of lambda, at least at infinite n. Okay, do we have any evidence for this conjecture? Well, the first piece of evidence was reviewed for us by Green in his talk. He reviewed the fact that the first possible correction to the infinite lambda result is zero for three-point couplings, essentially because the first possible correction is always fourth-order and fluctuations in supergravity fields. Okay, so that was heartening. And when I was writing these transparencies, I had suggested a possible check to this conjecture. I suggested that maybe somebody could calculate the order lambda correction to these three-point functions, correction to the free field results of these three-point functions. But we heard on the first day of this conference that Friedman and collaborators have actually performed this calculation and actually verified that this correction does vanish, exactly as this conjecture would predict. Okay, so these two pieces of evidence, I believe, are rather strong evidence in favor of our conjecture. Okay, the second point I'd like, or the second sort of, we also made a rather wild speculation. We speculated that perhaps the three-point functions are independent of lambda, not renormalized, not just at infinite n, but even at finite n. We had almost no evidence for this conjecture until this Monday, but once again, Friedman's calculation has provided, well, some amount of evidence for this conjecture. Remember, he found that the correlation the order lambda contribution to these correlation functions vanish even at finite n. Okay. The last comment I'd like to make before finishing is to emphasize that our result cannot be this non-renormalization conjecture cannot be true for four-point functions. This is because, as Banks and Green have shown in their paper, four-point functions definitely do receive corrections at first possible order from the large lambda result. Okay, that's all I really wanted to say. Thank you.
So questions, yes?
I'm not sure I understand how your very strongest conjecture can be consistent with what we know about the large alpha prime stuff, because the large alpha prime stuff shows that the three-point function is a particular power of alpha prime and a particular power of n to all orders in 1 over n, because the Einstein term is not renormalized at all in string theory. And your three-point function result, the free field result, is a non-trivial function of n because of the non-planar
diagram. Fine. So the question is, in string theory, it seems that quantum corrections do not renormalize the three-point graviton scattering amplitude. And so in string theory, it would seem that this three-point amplitude is not a function of n. However, our free field result clearly is a function of n. So if our strong conjecture is true, this seems like a contradiction. It is a contradiction only if the statement is true that quantum corrections do not renormalize the three-point graviton scattering. I know that this is true in flat space. I have never seen a proof of this in about the ADS 5 plus S 5 background.
So you're suggesting that the Einstein term gets renormalized?
That's right. I don't know that it does not.
More questions? Yes?
Well, I'm very sorry about that.
Yes?
Could you comment on three-point functions involving F minu, say F minu squared, F minu squared, F4?
Right. So the question is, could you comment on the three-point functions of descendants of these primaries? Dr. Zeitlin asked in particular about a specific set of descendants. He's asked for the three-point function of... Sorry. Where these squares and fourths are to be understood correctly. Well, firstly, this operator here is a descendant of trace XI, XJ. similarly, of course, for this operator, and this operator is a descendant of trace xi1, xi4. This is obtained from this by acting 4 q's on this, and this by acting 8 q's on that. Okay, so I suppose the question is, since the correlation functions of the primaries have not been renormalized, would a similar statement be true for these three-point functions? Do I understand the question correctly? Yes. I have to say I'm not completely sure of the answer to that question. My intuition would have said that the non-renormalization of primaries would imply an equivalent statement for all descendants. However, this depends on the fact that superconformal invariance constrains the functional form of three-point functions in x and theta, as viewed as a function of position and superspace coordinates, to ensure that there is only one linearly independent form consistent with all symmetries. If that statement is true, then a non-renormalization theorem must hold for these operators. However, it's been brought to my attention that there is some evidence that three-point functions of certain descendant operators do get renormalized, in which case it may be true that there isn't just one linearly independent form consistent with symmetries, in which case we can make a statement about non-renormalization functions of, well, some descendants but not all. So I do not know the answer to this question.
Okay, yes?
That set of functions probably zeros from your results, because trace x squared and trace x squared and the sugar multiple in trace x to the fourth is non, and your coupling is zero for this theorem.
Right, so that seems to be, an example of the kind of contradiction I was talking about. So the question was, from supergravity it seems that this correlation function is zero. However, from free field theory, it seems more or less clear that it's not zero. So it seems like there is a mismatch there. And yes, so it's probably true that this is one of the descendants whose non-renormalization is not guaranteed by the non-renormalization of primaries.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again.